24. The Bureau Lear refueled at Fargo and flew straight southwest to California. McGrath had argued again in favor of heading straight for Montana, but Webster had overruled him. One step at a time was Webster's patient way, so they were going to check out the Bull Borken story in California, and then they were going to Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado to meet with General Johnson. McGrath was about the only Bureau guy alive capable of shouting at Webster, and he had. But arguing is not the same thing as winning. So they were all in the air, heading first for Mojave. McGrath and Webster and Brogan and Milosevic, all overtired, overanxious, and morose in the hot, noisy cabin. "I need all the background I can get," Webster said. "They put me in personal charge, and these are not the type of guys I can be vague with, right?" McGrath glared at him and thought, "Don't play your stupid beltway games with Holly's life, Webster." But he said nothing, just sat tight until the tiny plane started arrowing down toward the airfield on the edge of the desert. They were on the ground just after 2 o'clock in the morning, West Coast time. The Mojave agent in charge met them on the deserted tarmac in his own car, drove them south through the sleeping town. "The Borkens were a Kendall family," he said. "Small town, 50 miles from here. Farming place, mostly citrus. One-man police department. The sheriff is waiting for us down there."
"You know anything?"
McGrath asked. The guy at the wheel shrugged. "Maybe," he said. "Small town, right?" 50 miles through the desert night at 85 took them just 36 minutes. Kendall was a small knot of buildings adrift in a sea of groves. There was a gas station, a general store, a grower's operation, and a low cement building with whip antennas spearing upward from the roof. A smart black and white was parked up on the apron outside. It was marked Kendall County Sheriff. There was a single light in the office window behind the car. The five agents stretched and yawned in the dry night air and trooped single file into the cement building. The Kendall County Sheriff was a guy about 60, solid, gray. He looked reliable. Webster waved him back into his seat, and McGrath laid the four glossy mug shots on his desk in front of him.
"You know these guys?" he asked.
The sheriff slid the photographs nearer and looked at each of them in turn. He picked them up and shuffled them into a new order, laid them back down on the desk like he was dealing a hand of giant playing cards. Then he nodded and reached down to his desk pedestal, rolled open the drawer, lifted out 3 buff files. He placed the files underneath 3 of the photographs, laid a stubby finger on the first face.
"Peter Wayne Bell," he said. "Mojave kid, but he was down here a lot. Not a very nice boy, as I believe you know."
He nodded across to his monitor screen on a computer card at the end of the desk. A page from the National Crime Center database was glowing green. It was the report from the North Dakota cops about the identity of the body they had found in a ditch. The identity and the history. The sheriff moved his wrist and laid a finger on the next photograph. It was the gunman who had pushed Holly Johnson into the back of the Lexus.
"Stephen Stewart," he said. "Called Stevie or Little Stevie. Farm boy, a couple of bushels short of a wagon load, know what I mean? Jumpy, jittery sort of a boy."
"What's in his file?" Webster asked. The sheriff shrugged.
"Nothing too serious," he said. "The boy was just too plain dumb for his own good. Group of kids would go out and mess around, and guess who'd be the one still stood there when I rolled up? Little Stevie, that's who. I locked him up 12 times, I guess, but he never did much of what you would want to call serious shit."
McGrath nodded and pointed to the photograph of the gunman who had gotten into the front seat of the Lexus.
"This guy?"
he asked. The sheriff moved his finger and laid it on the guy's glossy throat.
"Tony Loader," he said. "This is a fairly bad guy. Smarter than Stevie, dumber than you or me. I'll give you the file. Maybe it won't keep you Bureau guys awake nights, but it sure won't help you sleep any better than you were going to anyhow."
"What about the big guy?"
Webster asked. The sheriff jumped his finger along the row and shook his grizzled head.
"Never saw this guy before," he said. That's for damn sure. I'd remember him if I had.
We think maybe he's a foreigner, Webster said. Maybe European. Maybe he had an accent. That ring any bells with you? The sheriff just kept on shaking his head.
Never saw him before, he said again. I'd remember.
Okay, McGrath said. Bell, little Stevie Stewart, Tony Loader, and the mystery man. Where do these Borkin guys fit in?
The sheriff shrugged.
Old Dutch Borkin never fit in nowhere, he said. That was his problem. He was in Nam. Infantry grunt moved out here when he got out of the service. Brought a pretty wife and a little fat 10-year-old boy with him. Started growing citrus. Did pretty well for a long while. He was a strange guy. A loner, never saw much of him. But he was happy enough, I guess. Then the wife took sick and died, and the boy started acting weird. The market took a couple of hits. Profits were down. The growers all started getting into the banks for loans. Interest went up. Land went down. The collateral was disappearing. Irrigation water got expensive. They all started going belly up, one after the other. Borkin took it bad and swallowed his shotgun.
Webster nodded.
The little fat 10-year-old was Bo Borkin? He asked.
The sheriff nodded.
Bo Borkin, he said. Very strange boy. Very smart, but obsessed.
With what?
McGrath asked.
Mexicans started coming up, the sheriff said. Cheap labor? Young Bo was dead set against it. He started hollering about keeping Kendall white, joined the John Birch types.
So he was a racist, McGrath said.
At first, the sheriff said. Then he got into all that conspiracy stuff, talking about the Jews running the government or the United Nations or both or some damn thing. The government was all communists, taking over the world, secret plans for everything, big conspiracy against everybody, especially him. Banks controlled the government, or was it the government controlled the banks? Yeah. So the banks were all communists, and they are out to destroy America. He figured the exact reason the bank loaned his father the money was so it could default him later and give the farm to the Mexicans or the blacks or some damn thing. He was raving about it all the time.
So what happened? Webster said.
Well, of course, the bank did end up defaulting him, the sheriff said. The guy wasn't paying the loan, was he? But they didn't give his land to the Mexicans. They sold it on to the same big corporation owns everything else around here, which is owned by the pension funds, which probably means it's owned by you and me. Not communists or Mexicans or anybody else, right?
But the boy blamed the conspiracy for his father's death?
Brogan asked.
He sure did, the sheriff said. But the truth is, it was Bo himself who did for the old man. I figure old Dutch could have faced just about anything, except his only boy had turned out to be a complete lunatic, a cruel, selfish, weird boy. That's why he swallowed the damn shotgun, if you want to know the truth.
So where did Bo go? Webster asked.
Montana, the sheriff said. That's what I heard. He is into all those right-wing groups, you know, the militias. Built himself up to leader. Said the white man was going to have to stand and fight.
And those other guys went with him?
Brogan asked.
The three of them, for sure, the sheriff said. His big guy I never saw before. But little Stevie and Loader and Peter Bell, they were all in awe of Bo, like little robots. They all went up there together. They had a little cash, and they stripped the Borkin place of anything they could carry, and they headed north. Figured to buy some cheap land up there and defend themselves, you know. Although, against who, I can't say, because the way I hear it, there ain't nobody up there. And if there is, they're all white people anyway.
What's in his file? Webster asked. The sheriff shook his head.
Just about nothing, he said. Bo's way too smart to get caught doing anything bad.
But, McGrath said, he's doing stuff without getting caught.
The sheriff nodded.
That armored car robbery, he said. North of the state somewhere? I heard about that. Didn't stick to him, did it? I told you, way too smart.
Anything else we should know? Webster asked. The sheriff thought for a while and nodded again.
There was a fifth guy, he said, name of Odell Fowler. He'll turn up alongside a bull for sure, you can bet on that. Loader and Stevie and Bell get sent out doing mischief, you can be damn sure Borkin and Fowler are sitting there in the shadows pulling their strings.
Anything else? Webster said again.
Originally there was a sixth guy, the sheriff said. Guy named Packer. Six of them, all thick as thieves. But Packer took up with a Mexican girl. Couldn't help himself, I guess, just plain fell in love with her. Bo told him to stop seeing her. They fell out about it, a lot of tension going on. One day, Packer's not around anymore, and Bo is all smiling and relaxed. We found Packer out in a scrub, nailed to a big wooden cross, crucified, dead for a couple of days.
And you figure Borkin did it? Brogan asked.
Couldn't prove it, the sheriff replied. But I'm sure of it, and I'm sure he talked the others into helping him do it.
He's a born leader. He can talk anybody into doing anything. I can promise you that.
Kendall back to Mojave was 50 miles by car. Mojave to Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado was another 830 miles by Lear. 3 hours of travel, door to door, which put them down at Peterson through the gorgeous mountain dawn. It was the kind of sight people pay money to see, but the four FBI men took no notice at all. Thursday, July 3rd, the fourth day of the crisis, and no proper rest and no proper nutrition had left them ragged and focused on nothing except the job in hand. General Johnson himself was not available to meet them. He was elsewhere on the giant base, on duty, glad-handing the returning night patrols. His aide saluted Webster, shook hands with the other three, and walked them all over to a crew room reserved for their use. There was a huge photograph on the table, black and white, crisply focused, some kind of a landscape. It looked like the surface of the moon.
That's Anadir in Siberia, the aide said. Satellite photograph. Last week there was a big airbase there, a nuclear bomber base. The runway was aimed straight at our missile silos in Utah. Arms reduction treaty required it to be blown up. The Russians complied last week.
The four agents bent for another look. There was no trace of any man-made structure in the picture, just savage craters.
Complied? McGrath said. Looks like they did an enthusiastic job of work.
So? Webster said. The aide pulled a map from the portfolio, unfolded it, and stepped around so that the agents could share his view. It was a slice of the world, Eastern Asia and the Western United States, with the mass of Alaska right in the center and the North Pole right at the top. The aide stretched his thumb and finger apart and spanned the distance from Siberia southeast down to Utah.
Anadir was here, he said. Utah is here. Naturally, we knew all about the bomber base, and we had countermeasures in place, which included big missile bases in Alaska, here, and then a chain of four small surface-to-air facilities strung out north to south all the way underneath Anadir's flight path into Utah, which are here, 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 and here, straddling the line between Montana and the Idaho Panhandle.
The agents ignored the red dots in Idaho, but they looked closely at the locations in Montana.
What sort of bases are these? Webster asked.
The aide shrugged.
They were kind of temporary, he said. Thrown together in the 60s, just sort of survived ever since. Frankly, we didn't expect to have to use them. The Alaska missiles were more than adequate. Nothing would have gotten past them. But you know how it was, right? Couldn't be too ready.
What sort of weapons? McGrath asked.
There was a Patriot battery at each facility, the aide said. We pulled those out a while back, sold them to Israel. All that's left is Stingers. You know, shoulder-launch infantry systems.
Webster looked at the guy.
Stingers? He said. You were going to shoot Soviet bombers down with infantry systems?
The aide nodded, looked definite about it.
Why not? He said. Don't forget, those bases were basically window dressing.
Nothing was supposed to get past Alaska. But the Stingers would have worked. We supplied thousands of them to Afghanistan. They knocked down hundreds of Soviet planes. Mostly helicopters, I guess, but the principle is good. A heat seeker is a heat seeker, right? Makes no difference if it gets launched off a truck or off a GI's shoulder.
So what happens now? Webster asked him.
We're closing the bases down, the guy said. That's why the general is here, gentlemen. We're pulling the equipment and the personnel back here to Peterson, and there's going to be some ceremonies, you know, end-of-an-era stuff.
Where are these bases? McGrath asked. The Montana ones.
Exactly. The aide pulled the map closer and checked the references. Southernmost one is hidden on some farmland near Missoula, he said. Northern one is hidden in a valley about 40 miles south of Canada, near a little place called York. Why, is there a problem? McGrath shrugged.
We don't know yet, he said.
The aide showed them where to get breakfast and left them to wait for the general. Johnson arrived after the eggs, but before the toast, so they left the toast uneaten and walked back together to the crew room. Johnson looked a lot different from the glossy guy Webster had met with Monday evening. The early hour and 3 days' strain made him look 20 pounds thinner and 20 years older. His face was pale and his eyes were red. He looked like a man on the verge of defeat.
So, what do we know? He asked.
We think we know most of it, Webster answered. Right now, our operational assumption is your daughter's been kidnapped by a militia group from Montana. We know their location, more or less, somewhere in the northwestern valleys.
Johnson nodded slowly. Any communication? He asked. Webster shook his head.
Not yet, he said.
So what's the reason? Johnson asked. What do they want?
Webster shook his head again.
We don't know that yet, he said.
Johnson nodded again, vaguely.
Who are they? He asked.
McGrath opened the envelope he was carrying.
We've got four names, he said. Three of the Snatch Squad, and there's pretty firm evidence about who the militia leader is. A guy named Bo Borkin. That name mean anything to you?
Borkin, Johnson said. He shook his head.
That name means nothing. Okay, McGrath said. What about this guy? His name's Peter Bell.
McGrath passed Johnson the computer print of Bell at the wheel in the Lexus. Johnson took a long look at it and shook his head.
He's dead, McGrath said. Didn't make it back to Montana.
Good, Johnson said. McGrath passed him another picture.
Stephen Stewart, he said.
Johnson paid the prince some attention, but ended up shaking his head.
Never saw this guy before, he said. Tony Loader? McGrath asked.
Johnson stared at Loader's face and shook his head.
No, he said. Those three and Borkin are all from California, McGrath said. There may be another guy called Odell Fowler. You heard that name?
Johnson shook his head.
And there's this guy, McGrath said. We don't know who he is.
He passed over the photograph of the big guy. Johnson glanced at it, then glanced away, but then his gaze drifted back.
You know this one? McGrath asked him.
Johnson shrugged. He's vaguely familiar, he said. Maybe somebody I once saw?
Recently?
McGrath asked. Johnson shook his head.
Not recently, he said. Probably a long time ago.
Military?
Webster asked.
Probably, Johnson said again. Most of the people I see are military.
His aide crowded his shoulder for a look.
Means nothing to me, he said. But we should fax this to the Pentagon. If this guy is military, maybe there'll be somebody somewhere who served with him.
Johnson shook his head.
Fax it to the military police, he said. This guy's a criminal, right? Chances are he was in trouble before, in the service. Somebody there will remember him.
25. They came for him an hour after dawn. He was dozing on his hard chair, hands cuffed in his lap, Joseph Ray, awake and alert, opposite him. He had spent most of the night thinking about dynamite. Old dynamite,
left over from abandoned mining operations. He imagined hefting a stick in his hand, feeling the weight, figuring the volume of the cavity behind Holly's walls, picturing it packed with old dynamite. Old dynamite, rotting, the nitroglycerin sweating out, going unstable. Maybe a ton of unstable old dynamite packed in all around her. Still not so far gone it would explode with random movement, but gone bad enough it would explode under the impact of a stray artillery shell, or a stray bullet, or even a sharp blow with a hammer. Then there was a rattle of feet on shale as a detachment of men halted outside the hut. The door flung open, and Reacher turned his head and saw six guards. The point man clattered inside and hauled him up by the arm. He was dragged outside into the bright morning sun to face five men, line abreast, automatic rifles at the slope, camouflage fatigues, beards. He stood and squinted in the light. The rifle muzzles jerked him into rough formation, and the six men marched him across the diameter of the clearing to a narrow path running away from the sun into the forest. 50 yards in, there was another clearing, a rough, scrubby rectangle, small in area. Two plywood and cedar structures. Neither had any windows. The guards halted him, and the point man used his rifle barrel to indicate the left-hand building.
"Command hut," he said.
Then he pointed to the right.
"Punishment hut," he said. "We try to avoid that one."
The six men laughed with the secure confidence of an elite detachment, and the point man knocked on the command hut door, paused a beat, and opened it. Reacher was shoved inside with a rifle muzzle in the small of his back. The hut was blazing with light, electric bulbs added to green daylight from mossy skylights set into the roof. There was a plain oak desk and matching chairs, big old round things like Reacher had seen in old movies about newspaper offices or country banks. There was no decor except flags and banners nailed to the walls. There was a huge red swastika behind the desk, and several similar black-and-white motifs on the other walls. There was a detailed map of Montana pinned to a board on the back wall. A tiny portion of the northwest corner of the state was outlined in black. There were bundles of pamphlets and manuals stacked on the bare floor. One was titled, "Dry It, You'll Like It." It claimed to show how food could be preserved to withstand a siege. Another claimed to show how guerrillas could derail passenger trains. There was a polished mahogany bookcase, incongruously fine, packed with books. The bar of daylight from the door fell across them and illuminated their cloth spines and gold-blocked titles. There were standard histories of the art of war, translations from German and Japanese. There was a whole shelf with texts about Pearl Harbor, texts that Reacher himself had studied, elsewhere and a long time ago. He stood still. Borkin was behind the desk. His hair gleamed white in the light. The black uniform showed up gray. Borkin was just staring silently at him. Then he waved him to a chair, motioned the guards to wait outside. Reacher sat heavily. Fatigue was gnawing at him, and adrenaline was burning his stomach. The guards tramped across the floor and stepped outside. They closed the door quietly. Borkin moved his arm and rolled open a drawer, took out an ancient handgun, laid it on the desktop with a loud clatter.
"I made my decision," he said, "about whether you live or die."
Then he pointed at the old revolver lying on the desk.
"You know what this is?"
he asked. Reacher glanced at it through the glare and nodded. "It's a Marshall Colt," he said. Borkin nodded.
"You bet your ass it is," he said. "It's an original 1873 Marshall Colt, just like the U.S. cavalry were given. It's my personal weapon."
He picked it up, right-handed, and hefted it.
"You know what it fires?" he said.
Reacher nodded again. 45, he said. 6 shots.
"Right first time," Borkin said. 6 45s, 900 feet per second out of a 7.5-inch barrel. You know what those bullets could do to you?
Reacher shrugged. Depends if they hit me or not, he said. Borkin looked blank. Then he grinned. His wet mouth curled upward, and his tight cheeks nearly forced his eyes shut.
Oh, they'd hit you, he said. If I'm firing, they'd hit you.
Reacher shrugged again. From there, maybe, he said.
From anywhere, Borkin said. From here, from 50 feet, from 50 yards. If I'm firing, they'd hit you.
Hold up your right hand, Reacher said. Borkin looked blank again. Then he put the gun down and held up his huge white hand, like he was waving to a vague acquaintance or taking an oath. Bullshit, Reacher said.
Bullshit,
Borkin repeated. For sure, Reacher said. That gun's reasonably accurate, but it's not the best weapon in the world. To hit a man at 50 yards with it, you'd need to practice like crazy. And you haven't been.
I haven't,
Borkin said. No, you haven't, Reacher said. Look at the damn thing. It was designed in the 1870s, right? You seen old photographs? People were much smaller. Scrappy little guys, just immigrated from Europe, been starving for generations. Small people, small hands. Look at the stock on that thing. Tight curve, way too small for you. You grab that thing, your hand looks like a bunch of bananas around it. And that stock is 120-year-old walnut, hard as a rock. The back of the stock and the end of the frame below the hammer would be pounding you with the recoil. You use that gun a lot, you'd have a pad of callus between your thumb and forefinger I could see from here. But you haven't. So don't tell me you've been practicing with it. And don't tell me you can be a marksman without practicing with it. Borkin looked hard at him. Then he smiled again. His wet lips parted, and his eyes closed into slits. He rolled open the opposite drawer and lifted out another handgun. It was a Sig Sauer 9mm, maybe 5 years old. Well used, but well maintained. A big, boxy grip for a big hand.
I lied, he said. This is my personal weapon, and now I know something. I know my decision was the right one.
He paused so Reacher could ask him about his decision. Reacher stayed silent, clamped his lips. He wasn't about to ask him about anything, not even if it would be the last sentence he would ever live to say.
We're serious here, you know, Borkin said to him. Totally serious. We're not playing games, and we're correct about what's going on.
He paused again so Reacher could ask him what was going on. Reacher said nothing, just sat and stared into space.
America has got a despotic government, Borkin said. A dictatorship, controlled from abroad by our enemies. Our current president is a member of a world government which controls our lives in secret. His federal system is a smokescreen for total control. They're planning to disarm us and enslave us. It started already. Let's be totally clear about that.
He paused, picked up the old revolver again. Reacher saw him checking the fit of the stock in his hand, felt the charisma radiating out of him, felt compelled to listen to the soft, hypnotic voice.
Two main methods, Borkin said. The first is the attempt to disarm the civilian population. The Second Amendment guarantees our right to bear arms, but they're going to abolish that. The gun laws, all this beefing about crime, homicides, drug wars, it's all aimed at disarming people like us. And when we're disarmed, they can do what they like with us, right? That's why it was in the Constitution in the first place. Those old guys were smart. They knew the only thing that could control a government was the people's willingness and ability to shoot them down.
Borkin paused again. Reacher stared up at the swastika behind his head.
Second method is the squeeze on small business, Borkin said. This is a personal theory of mine. You don't hear it much around the movement, but I spotted it. It puts me way ahead of the others in my understanding.
Borkin waited, but Reacher still stayed silent, looking away.
It's obvious, right?
Borkin said to him.
World government is basically a communistic type of government. They don't want a strong, small business sector. But that's what America had. Millions of people all working hard for themselves and making a living. Too many just to murder out of hand when the time comes. So the numbers have to be reduced in advance. So the federal government was instructed to squeeze the small businessman. They put on all kinds of regulations, all kinds of laws and taxes. They rig the markets. They bring the small guy to his knees. Then they order the banks to come sniffing around with attractive loans. And as soon as the ink is dry on the loan papers, they jack up the interest and rig the market some more until the poor guy defaults. Then they take away his business. And so that's one less for the gas ovens when the time comes.
Reacher glanced at him, said nothing.
Believe it, Borkin said. It's like they're solving a corpse disposal problem in advance. Get rid of the middle class now. They don't need so many concentration camps later.
Reacher was just staring at Borkin's eyes, like looking at a bright light. The fat, red lips were smiling an indulgent smile.
I told you, we're way ahead of the others, he said. We've seen it coming. What else is the Federal Reserve for? That's the key to the whole thing. America was basically a nation founded on business, right? Control business, you control everything. How do you control business? You control the banks. How do you control the banks? You set up a bullshit Federal Reserve system. You tell the banks what to do. That's the key. The world government controls everything through the Fed. I've seen it happen.
His eyes were open wide, shining with no color.
I saw them do it to my own father,
he screamed.
May his poor soul rest in peace. The Fed bankrupted him.
Reacher tore his gaze away, shrugged at the corner of the room, said nothing. He started trying to recall the sequence of titles in Borkin's fine mahogany bookcase. Warfare from ancient China through Renaissance Italy through Pearl Harbor. He concentrated on naming the titles to himself, left to right, trying to resist the glare of Borkin's attention.
We're serious here, Borkin was saying again. You may look at me and think I'm some kind of a despot or a cult leader or whatever the world would want to label me, but I'm not. I'm a good leader. I won't deny that. Even an inspired leader. Call me intelligent and perceptive. I won't argue with you. But I don't need to be. My people don't need any encouraging. They don't need much leading. They need guidance and they need discipline, but don't let that fool you. I'm not coercing anybody. Don't make the mistake of underestimating their will. Don't ignore their desire for a change for the better.
Reacher was silent. He was still concentrating on the books, skimming in his mind through the events of December 1941, as seen from the Japanese point of view.
We're not criminals here, you know, Borkin was saying. When a government turns bad, it's the very best people who stand up against it. Or do you think we should all just act like sheep?
Reacher risked another glance at him, risked speaking. You're pretty selective, he said, about who's here and who's not. Borkin shrugged.
Like unto like, he said. That's nature's way, isn't it? Black people have got the whole of Africa. White people have got this place.
What about Jewish dentists? Reacher asked. What place have they got?
Borkin shrugged again.
That was an operational error, he said. Loder should have waited until he was clear. But mistakes happen.
Should have waited until I was clear, too, Reacher said.
Borkin nodded.
I agree with you, he said. It would have been better for you that way. But they didn't, and so here you are among us.
Just because I'm white? Reacher said.
Don't knock it, Borkin replied. White people got precious few rights left.
Reacher stared at him, stared around the bright, hate-filled room, shuddered.
I've made a study of tyranny,
Borkin said,
and how to combat it. The first rule is you make a firm decision to live free or die, and you mean it. Live free or die. The second rule is you don't act like a sheep. You stand up and you resist them. You study their system and you learn to hate it, and then you act. But how do you act? The brave man fights back. He retaliates, right?
Reacher shrugged, said nothing.
The brave man retaliates, Borkin repeated. But the man who is both brave and clever acts differently. He retaliates first, in advance. He strikes the first blows. He gives them what they don't expect, when and where they don't expect it. That's what we're doing here. We're retaliating first. It's their war, but we're going to strike the first blows. We're going to give them what they don't expect. We're going to upset their plans.
Reacher glanced back at the bookcase. 5,000 classic pages, all saying the same thing. Don't do what they expect you to do.
Go look at the map,
Borkin said. Reacher thrust his cuffed hands forward and lifted himself awkwardly out of the chair. Walked over to the map of Montana on the wall. He found York in the top left-hand corner, well inside the small black outline. He checked the scale and looked at the contour shading and the colors. The river Joseph Ray had talked about lay 30 miles to the west, on the other side of high mountains. It was a thick blue slash running down the map. There were enormous brown heights shown to the north, all the way up to Canada. The only road ran north through York and terminated at some abandoned mine workings. A few haphazard tracks ran through solid forest to the east. To the south, contour lines merged together to show a tremendous east-west ravine.
Look at that terrain, Reacher,
Borkin said quietly.
What does it tell you?
Reacher looked at it. It told him he couldn't get out. Not on foot. Not with Holly. There were weeks of rough walking east and north. Natural barriers west and south. The terrain made a better prison than wire fences or minefields could have. He had once been in Siberia, after Glasnost, following up on ancient stories about Korean MIAs. The gulags had been completely open. No wire. No barriers. He had asked his hosts, but where are the fences? The Russians had pointed out over the miles of snow and said, there are the fences. Nowhere to run. He looked up at the map again. The terrain was the barrier. To get out was going to require a vehicle and a lot of luck.
They can't get in, Borkin said. We're impregnable. We can't be stopped. And we mustn't be stopped. That would be a disaster of truly historic proportions. Suppose the Redcoats had stopped the American Revolution in 1776.
Reacher glanced around the tiny wooden room and shuddered. This isn't the American Revolution, he said.
Isn't it? Borkin asked. How is it different? They wanted freedom from a tyrannical government, so do we.
You're murderers, Reacher said.
So they were in 1776, Borkin said. They killed people. The established system called that murder, too.
You're racists, Reacher said.
Same in 1776, Borkin said. Jefferson and his slaves, they knew black people were inferior. Back then, they were exactly the same as we are now. But then they became the new redcoats. Slowly, over the years, it's fallen to us to get back to how it should have stayed. Live free or die, Reacher. It's a noble aim. Always has been, don't you think?
He was leaning forward with his great bulk pressing tight against the desk. His hands were in the air. His colorless eyes were shining.
But there were mistakes made in 1776, he said. I've studied the history. War could have been avoided if both sides had acted sensibly. And war should always be avoided, don't you think?
Reacher shrugged.
Not necessarily, he said.
Well, you're going to help us avoid it,
Porkin said.
That's my decision. You're going to be my emissary.
You're what? Reacher said.
You're independent, Porkin said. Not one of us, no axe to grind. An American like them. An upstanding citizen, no felony convictions. A clever, perceptive man. You notice things. They'll listen to you.
What? Reacher said again.
We're organized here, Porkin said. We're ready for nationhood. You need to understand that. We have an army. We have a treasury. We have financial reserves. We have a legal system. We have democracy. I'm going to show all that to you today. I'm going to show you a society ready for independence, ready to live free or die, and 2 days away from doing so. Then I'm going to send you south to America. You're going to tell them our position is strong and their position is hopeless.
Reacher just stared at him.
And you can tell them about Holly,
Porkin said quietly,
in her special little room. You can tell them about my secret weapon, my insurance policy.
You're crazy, Reacher said. The hut went silent, quieter than silent.
Why?
Porkin whispered.
Why am I crazy? Exactly.
You're not thinking straight, Reacher said. Don't you realize that Holly counts for nothing? The president will replace Johnson faster than you can blink an eye. They'll crush you like a bug, and Holly will be just another casualty. You should send her back out with me.
Porkin was shaking his bloated head, happily, confidently. No, he said. That won't happen. There's more to Holly than who her father is. Hasn't she told you that?
Reacher stared at him, and Porkin checked his watch.
Time to go, he said. Time for you to see our legal system at work.
Holly heard the quiet footsteps outside her door and eased off the bed. The lock clicked back, and the young soldier with the scarred forehead stepped up into the room. He had his finger to his lips, and Holly nodded. She limped to the bathroom and set the shower running noisily into the empty tub. The young soldier followed her in and closed the door.
We can only do this once a day, Holly whispered. They'll get suspicious if they hear the shower too often.
The young guy nodded.
We'll get out tonight, he said. Can't do it this morning. We're all on duty at Loder's trial. I'll come by just after dusk with a jeep. We'll make a run for it in the dark, head south. Risky, but we'll make it. Not without Reacher, Holly said.
The young guy shook his head.
Can't promise that, he said. He's in with Porkin now. God knows what's going to happen to him. I go, he goes, Holly said.
The young guy looked at her nervously.
Okay, he said. I'll try.
He opened the bathroom door and crept out. Holly watched him go and turned the shower off, stared after him. He looped north and west and took a long route back through the woods, same way as he had come. The sentry Fowler had hidden in the trees 15 feet off the main path never saw him, but the one he had hidden in the backwoods did. He caught a glimpse of a camouflage uniform hustling through the undergrowth. Spun around fast, but was too late to make the face. He shrugged and thought hard. Figured he'd keep it to himself. Better to ignore it than report he'd failed to make the actual ID. So the young man with the scar hurried all the way and was back in his hut 2 minutes before he was due to escort his commander down to the tribunal hearing. In the daylight, the courthouse on the southeast corner of the abandoned town of York looked pretty much the same as 100 others Reacher had seen all over rural America. Built early in the century. Big, white, pillared, ornate. enough square solidity to communicate its serious purpose, but enough lightness in its details to make it a handsome structure. He saw a fine cupola floating off the top of the building with a fine clock in it, probably paid for by a public subscription held long ago among a long-forgotten generation, more or less the same as 100 others, but the roof was steeper pitched than some and heavier built. He guessed it had to be that way in the north of Montana. That roof could be carrying 100 tons of snow all winter long. But this was the third morning of July, and there was no snow on the roof. Reacher was warm after walking a mile in the pale northern sun. Borkin had gone ahead separately, and Reacher had been marched down through the forest by the same 6 elite guards, still in handcuffs. They marched him straight up the front steps and inside. The first floor interior was one large space, interrupted by pillars holding up the second floor, paneled in broad, smooth planks sawed from huge pines. The wood was dark from age and polish, and the panels were stern and simple in their design. Every seat was taken, every bench was full. The room was a sea of camouflage green. Men and women, sitting rigidly upright, rifles exactly vertical between their knees, waiting expectantly. Some children, silent and confused. Reacher was led in front of the crowd, over to a table in the well of the court. Fowler was waiting there, Stevie next to him. He nodded to a chair. Reacher sat. The guards stood behind him. A minute later, the double doors opened, and Bo Borkin walked over to the judge's bench. The old floor creaked beneath his bulk. Every person in the room except Reacher stood up, stood to attention and saluted, as if they were hearing an inaudible cue. Borkin was still in his black uniform, with belt and boots. He had added a large holster to hold his Sig Sauer. He held a slim, leather-bound book. He came in with 6 armed men in a loose formation. They took up station in front of the bench and stood at rigid attention, gazing forward, looking blank. The people sat down again. Reacher glanced up at the ceiling and quartered it with his eyes, worked out which was the southeast corner. The doors opened again and the crowd drew breath. Loader was pushed into the room. He was surrounded by 6 guards. They pushed him to the table opposite Fowler's, the accused's table. The guards stood behind him and forced him into the chair with their hands on both his shoulders. His face was white with fear and crusted with blood. His nose was broken and his lips were split. Borkin stared across at him, sat down heavily in the judge's chair and placed his big hands, palms down, on the bench, looked around the quiet room, and spoke.
"We all know why we're here," he said.
Holly could sense there was a big crowd in the room below her. She could feel the faint rumble of a body of people holding themselves still and quiet. But she didn't stop working. No reason to believe her bureau contact would fail, but she was still going to spend the day preparing, just in case. Her search for a tool had led her to the one she had brought in with her, her metal crutch. It was a 1-inch aluminum tube with an elbow clip and a handle. The tube was too wide and the metal was too soft to act as a pry bar. But she realized that maybe if she pulled the rubber foot off, the open end of the tube could be molded into a makeshift wrench. She could maybe crush the tube around the shape of the bolts holding the bed together. Then she could bend the tube at a right angle and maybe use the whole thing like a flimsy tire iron. But first, she had to scrape away the thick paint on the bolts. It was smooth and slick, and it welded the bolts to the frame. She used the edge of the elbow clip to flake the top layers. Then she scraped at the seams until she saw bright metal. Now, her idea was to limp back and forth from the bathroom with a towel soaked in hot water. She would press the towel hard on the bolts and let the heat from the water expand the metal and crack its grip. Then the soft aluminum of the crutch might just prove strong enough
to do the job.
Reckless endangerment of the mission,
Bo Borken said. His voice was low and hypnotic. The room was quiet. The guards in front of the judge's bench stared forward. The guard at the end was staring at Reacher. He was the younger guy with the trimmed beard and the scar on his forehead Reacher had seen guarding Loder the previous night. He was staring at Reacher with curiosity. Borken held up the slim, leather-bound volume and swung it slowly, left to right, like it was a searchlight, and he wanted to bathe the whole of the room with its bright beam.
"The Constitution of the United States," he said. "Sadly abused, but the greatest political tract ever devised by man. The model for our own Constitution."
He turned the pages of the book. The rustle of stiff paper was loud in the quiet room. He started reading.
"The Bill of Rights," he said. "The Fifth Amendment specifies no person shall be held to answer for a capital crime without a grand jury indictment, except in cases arising in the militia in times of public danger. It says no person shall be deprived of life or liberty without due process of law. The Sixth Amendment specifies the accused shall have the right to a speedy public trial in front of a local jury. It says the accused has the right to assistance of counsel."
Borken stopped again, looked around the room, held up the book.
"This book tells us what to do," he said. "So we need a jury. Doesn't say how many. I figure 3 men will do. Volunteers?"
There was a flurry of hands. Borken pointed randomly here and there, and 3 men walked across the pine floor. They stacked their rifles and filed into the jury box. Borken turned in his seat and spoke to them.
"Gentlemen," he said, "this is a militia matter, and this is a time of public danger. Are we agreed on that?"
The new jurymen all nodded, and Borken turned and looked down from the bench toward Loder, alone at his table.
"You had counsel?" he said.
"You offering me a lawyer now?"
Loder asked. His voice was thick and nasal. Borken shook his head.
"There are no lawyers here," he said. "Lawyers are what went wrong with the rest of America. We're not going to have lawyers here. We don't want them. The Bill of Rights doesn't say anything about lawyers. It says counsel. Counsel means advice. That's what my dictionary says. You had advice? You want any?"
"You got any?"
Loder said. Borken nodded and smiled a cold smile.
"Plead guilty," he said.
Loder just shook his head and dropped his eyes.
"Okay,"
Borken said.
"You've had counsel, but you're pleading not guilty."
Loder nodded. Borken looked down at his book again, turned back to the beginning.
"The Declaration of Independence," he said. "It is the right of the people to alter or to abolish the old government and to institute new government in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness."
He stopped and scanned the crowd.
"You all understand what that means?"
he said.
"The old laws are gone. Now we have new laws, new ways of doing things. We're putting right 200 years of mistakes. We're going back to where we should have been all along. This is the first trial under a brand new system, a better system, a system with a far stronger claim to legitimacy. We have the right to do it, and what we are doing is right."
There was a slight murmur from the crowd. Reacher detected no disapproval in the sound. They were all hypnotized, basking in Borken's bright glow like reptiles in a hot noontime sun. Borken nodded to Fowler. Fowler stood up next to Reacher and turned to the jury box.
"The facts are these," Fowler said. "The commander sent Loder out on a mission of great importance to all our futures. Loder performed badly. He was gone for just 5 days. But he made 5 serious mistakes.
mistakes which could have wrecked the whole venture. Specifically, he left a trail by burning two vehicles. Then he mistimed two operations and thereby snarled up two civilians. And finally, he allowed Peter Bell to desert. 5 serious mistakes.
Fowler stood there. Reacher stared at him, urgently.
"I'm calling a witness," Fowler said.
"Stevie Stewart?"
Little Stevie stood up fast, and Fowler nodded him across to the old witness box, alongside and below the judge's bench. Borken leaned down and handed him a black book. Reacher couldn't see what book it was, but it wasn't a Bible, not unless they had started making Bibles with swastikas on the cover.
"You swear to tell the truth here?"
Borken asked. Stevie nodded.
I do, sir, he said.
He put the book down and turned to Fowler, ready for the first question.
"The 5 mistakes I mentioned," Fowler said. "You see Loader make them?"
Stevie nodded again.
He made them, he said.
"He take responsibility for them?" Fowler asked.
"Sure did," Stevie said. "He played the big boss the whole time we were away."
Fowler nodded Stevie back to the table. The courtroom was silent. Borken smiled knowingly at the juryman and glanced down at Loader.
"Anything to say in your defense?" he asked quietly.
The way he said it, he made it seem absurd that anybody could possibly dream up any kind of defense to those kinds of charges. The courtroom stayed silent. Still, Borken was watching the crowd. Every pair of eyes was locked onto the back of Loader's head.
"Anything to say?"
Borken asked him again. Loader stared forward, made no reply. Borken turned toward the jury box and looked at the 3 men sitting on the old worn benches, looked a question at them. The 3 men huddled for a second and whispered. Then the guy on the left stood up.
"Guilty, sir," he said.
"Definitely guilty."
Borken nodded in satisfaction.
"Thank you, gentlemen," he said.
The crowd set up a buzz. He turned to quell it with a look.
"I am required to pass sentence," he said. "As many of you know, Loader is an old acquaintance of mine. We go back a long way. We were childhood friends, and friendship means a great deal to me."
He paused and looked down at Loader.
"But other things mean more," he said. "Performance of my duties means more. My responsibility to this emerging nation means more. Sometimes statesmanship must be put above every other value a man holds dear."
The crowd was silent, holding its breath. Borken sat for a long moment. Then he glanced over Loader's head at the guards behind him and made a small, delicate motion with his head. The guards grabbed Loader's elbows and hauled him to his feet. They formed up and hustled him out of the room. Borken stood and looked at the crowd. Then he turned and walked to the doors and was gone. The people in the public benches shuffled to their feet and hurried out after him. Reacher saw the guards walking Loader to a flagpole on the patch of lawn outside the courthouse. Borken was striding after them. The guards reached the flagpole and shoved Loader hard up against it, facing it. They held his wrists and pulled, so he was pressed up against the pole, hugging it, face tight against the dull white paint. Borken came up behind him, pulled the Sig Sauer from its holster, clicked the safety catch, cocked around into the chamber, jammed the muzzle into the back of Loader's neck, and fired. There was an explosion of pink blood, and the roar of the shot cannoned back off the mountains.
26. "His name is Jack Reacher," Webster said.
"Good call, General," McGrath said. "I guess they remembered him."
Johnson nodded.
"Military police keeps good records," he said.
They were still in the commandeered crew room inside Peterson Air Force Base, 10 o'clock in the morning, Thursday, July 3rd. The fax machine was rolling out a long reply to their inquiry. The face in the photograph had been identified immediately.
The subject's service record had been pulled straight off the Pentagon computer and faxed along with the name.
"You recall this guy now?" Brogan asked.
"Reacher?" Johnson repeated vaguely.
"I don't know. What did he do?"
Webster and the general's aide were crowding the machine, reading the report as the paper spooled out. They twisted it right side up and walked slowly away to keep it up off the floor.
"What did he do?"
McGrath asked them urgently.
"Nothing," Webster said.
"Nothing?"
McGrath repeated.
"Why would they have a record on him if he didn't do anything?"
"He was one of them," Webster said. "Major Jack Reacher, Military Police." The aide was racing through the length of paper.
"Silver Star," he said. "Two bronzes, Purple Heart. This is a hell of a record, sir. This guy was a hero, for God's sake."
McGrath opened up his envelope and pulled out the original video pictures of the kidnap. Black and white, unenlarged, grainy. He selected the first picture of Reacher's involvement, the one catching him in the act of seizing Holly's crutch and pulling the dry cleaning from her grasp. He slid the photograph across the table.
"Big hero," he said.
Johnson bent to study the picture. McGrath slid over the next, the one showing Reacher gripping Holly's arm, keeping her inside the tight crush of attackers. Johnson picked it up and stared at it. McGrath wasn't sure whether he was staring at Reacher or at his daughter.
"He's 37, the general's aide read aloud. "Mustered out 14 months ago. West Point, 13 years service. Big heroics in Beirut right at the start. Sir, you pinned a bronze on him 10 years ago. This is an absolutely outstanding record throughout. He's the only non-Marine in history to win the Wimbledon."
Webster looked up. "Tennis?" he said. The aide smiled briefly.
"Not Wimbledon," he said. "The Wimbledon. Marine Sniper School runs a competition, the Wimbledon Cup, for snipers. Open to anybody, but a Marine always wins it, except one year Reacher won it."
"So why didn't he serve as a sniper?" McGrath asked.
The aide shrugged.
"Beats me," he said. "Lots of puzzles in this record. Like, why did he leave the service at all? A guy like this should have made it all the way to the top."
Johnson had a picture in each hand, and he was staring closely at them.
"So why did he leave?" Brogan asked. "Any trouble?"
The aide shook his head, scanned the paper.
"Nothing in the record," he said. "No reason given. We were shedding numbers at the time, but the idea was to cull the no-hopers. A guy like this shouldn't have been shaken out."
Johnson switched the photographs into the opposite hands, like he was looking for a fresh perspective.
"Anybody know him real well?" Milosevic asked. "Anybody we can talk to?"
"We can dig up his old commander, I guess," the aide said. "Might take us a day to get hold of him."
"Do it," Webster said. "We need information. Anything at all will help."
Johnson put the photographs down and slid them back to McGrath.
"He must have turned bad," he said. "Sometimes happens. Good men can turn bad. I've seen it myself, time to time. It can be a hell of a problem."
McGrath reversed the photographs on the shiny table and stared at them.
"You're not kidding," he said.
Johnson looked back at him.
"Can I keep that picture?" he said.
"The first one?" McGrath shook his head.
"No," he said. "You want a picture? I'll take one myself. You and your daughter standing together in front of a headstone. This asshole's name on it."
27. Four men were dragging Loader's body away, and the crowd was dispersing quietly. Reacher was left standing on the courthouse steps with his six guards and Fowler. Fowler had finally unlocked the handcuffs. Reacher was rolling his shoulders and stretching. He had been cuffed all night and all morning, and he was stiff and sore. His wrists were marked with red weals where the hard metal had bitten down.
"Cigarette?"
Fowler asked. He was holding his pack out, a friendly gesture. Reacher shook his head.
"I want to see Holly," he said.
Fowler was about to refuse, but then he thought some more and nodded.
"Okay," he said. "Good idea. Take her out for some exercise. Talk to her. Ask her how we're treating her. That's something you're sure to be asked later. It'll be very important to them. We don't want you giving them any false impressions."
Reacher waited at the bottom of the steps. The sun had gone pale and watery. Wisps of mist were gathering in the north, but some of the sky was still blue and clear. After 5 minutes, Fowler brought Holly down. She was walking slowly with a little staccato rhythm as her good leg alternated with the thump of her crutch. She walked through the door and stood at the top of the steps.
"Question for you, Reacher," Fowler called down. "How far can you run in a half hour with 120 pounds on your back?"
Reacher shrugged. "Not far enough, I guess," he said. Fowler nodded.
"Right," he said. "Not far enough. If she's not standing right here in 30 minutes, we'll come looking for you. We'll give it a 2-mile radius."
Reacher thought about it and nodded. A half hour with 120 pounds on his back might get him more than 2 miles. 2 miles was probably pessimistic. But he thought back to the map on Borkin's wall, thought about the savage terrain. Where the hell would he run? He made a show of checking his watch. Fowler walked away, up behind the ruined office building. The guards slung their weapons over their shoulders and stood easy. Holly smoothed her hair back, stood face up to the pale sun. "Can you walk for a while?" Reacher asked her.
"Slowly," she said.
She set off north along the middle of the deserted street. Reacher strolled beside her. They waited until they were out of sight. They glanced at each other. Then they turned and flung themselves together. Her crutch toppled to the ground, and he lifted her a foot in the air. She wrapped her arms around him and buried her face in his neck.
"I'm going crazy in there," she said.
"I've got bad news," he said.
"What?"
she said. "They had a helper in Chicago," he said. She stared up at him. "They were only gone 5 days," he said. "That's what Fowler said at the trial. He said Loder had been gone just 5 days."
"So?"
she said. "So they didn't have time for surveillance," he said. "They hadn't been watching you. Somebody told them where you were going to be and when. They had help, Holly." The color in her face drained away. It was replaced by shock.
5 days?
She said.
"You sure?"
Reacher nodded. Holly went quiet. She was thinking hard. "So who knew?" he asked her. "Who knew where you'd be 12 o'clock Monday? A roommate? A friend?" Her eyes were darting left and right. She was racing through the possibilities.
"Nobody knew,"
she said. "Were you ever tailed?" he asked. She shrugged helplessly. Reacher could see she desperately wanted to say, "Yes, I was tailed," because he knew to say no was too awful for her to contemplate. "Were you?" he asked again.
"No,"
she said quietly.
"By a bozo like one of these? Forget it. I'd have spotted them. And they'd have had to hang around all day outside the federal building just waiting. We'd have picked them up in a heartbeat."
"So?" he asked.
"My lunch break was flexible," she said. "It varied, sometimes by a couple of hours either way. It was never regular."
"So?" he asked again. She stared at him.
"So it was inside help," she said. "Inside the bureau. Had to be. Think about it, no other possibility. Somebody in the office saw me leave and dropped a dime."
He said nothing, just watched the dismay on her face.
"A mole inside Chicago,"
she said. A statement, not a question.
"Inside the bureau. No other possibility. Shit! I don't believe it."
Then she smiled, a brief, bitter smile.
"And we've got a mole inside here," she said. "Ironic, right? He identified himself to me. Young guy, big scar on his forehead. He's undercover for the Bureau. He says we've got people in a lot of these groups. Deep undercover, in case of emergency. He called it in when they put the dynamite in my walls."
He stared back at her. "You know about the dynamite?" he said. She grimaced and nodded. "No wonder you're going crazy in there," he said. Then he stared at her in a new panic. "Who does this undercover guy call into?" he asked urgently.
Our office in Butte? Holly said. It's just a satellite office. One resident agent. He communicates by radio. He's got a transmitter hidden out in the woods, but he's not using it now. He says they're scanning the frequencies.
He shuddered. So how long before the Chicago mole blows his cover? He said. Holly went paler.
Soon, I guess, she said. Soon as somebody figures we were headed out in this direction. Chicago will be dialing up the computers and trolling for any reports coming out of Montana. His stuff will be at the top of the damn pile. Christ, Reacher, you've got to get to him first. You've got to warn him. His name is Jackson.
They turned back, started hurrying south through the ghost town.
He says he can break me out, Holly said. Tonight, by Jeep.
Reacher nodded grimly. Go with him, he said.
Not without you, she said.
They're sending me anyway, he said. I'm supposed to be an emissary. I'm supposed to tell your people it's hopeless.
Are you going to go? She asked.
He shook his head. Not if I can help it, he said. Not without you.
You should go, she said. Don't worry about me.
He shook his head again. I am worrying about you, he said.
Just go, she said. Forget me and get out.
He shrugged. Said nothing.
Get out if you get the chance, Reacher, she said. I mean it.
She looked like she meant it. She was glaring hard at him. Only if you're gone first, he said finally. I'm sticking around until you're out of here. I'm definitely not leaving you with these maniacs.
But you can't stick around, she said. If I'm gone, they'll go apeshit. It'll change everything.
He looked at her, heard Borkin say, she's more than his daughter. Why, Holly, he said. Why will it change everything? Who the hell are you? She didn't answer, glanced away. Fowler strolled into view, coming north, smoking. He walked up to them, stopped right in front of them, pulled his pack.
Cigarette?
He asked. Holly looked at the ground. Reacher shook his head.
She tell you? Fowler asked. All the comforts of home?
The guards were standing to attention. They were in a sort of honor guard on the courthouse steps. Fowler walked Holly to them. A guard took her inside. At the door, she glanced back at Reacher. He nodded to her, tried to make it say, see you later, okay? Then she was gone.
Now for the grand tour, Fowler said. You stick close to me, Bo's orders, but you can ask any questions you want, okay?
Reacher glanced vaguely at him and nodded, glanced at the six guards behind him. He walked down the steps and paused, looked over at the flagpole. It was set dead center in the remains of a fine square of lawn in front of the building. He walked across to it and stood in Loder's blood and looked around. The town of York was pretty much dead. Looked like it had died some time ago, and it looked like it had never been much of a place to begin with. The road came through north to south, and there had been four developed blocks flanking it, two on the east side and two on the west. The courthouse took up the whole of the southeastern block, and it faced what might have been some kind of a county office on the southwestern block. The western side of the street was higher. The ground sloped way up. The foundation of the county office building was about level with the second floor of the courthouse. It had started out the same type of structure, but it had fallen into ruin maybe 30 years before. The paint was peeled, and the siding showed through iron gray. There was no glass in any window. The sloping knoll surrounding it had returned to mountain scrub. There had been an ornamental tree dead center. It had died a long time ago, and it was now just a stump, maybe 7 feet high, like an execution post. The northern blocks were rows of faded, boarded-up stores. There had once been tall, ornate frontages concealing simple, square buildings, but the decay of the years had left the frontages the same dull brown as the boxy wooden structures behind. The signs above the doors had faded to nothing. There were no people on the sidewalks, no vehicle noise, no activity, no nothing.
The place was a ghost. It looked like an abandoned cowboy town from the Old West.
This was a mining town, Fowler said. Lead, mostly, but some copper, and a couple of seams of good silver, for a while. There was a lot of money made here, that's for damn sure.
So what happened? Reacher asked. Fowler shrugged.
What happens to any mining place? He said. It gets worked out, is what? 50 years ago, people were registering claims in that old county office like there was no tomorrow, and they were disputing them in that old courthouse, and there were saloons and banks and stores up and down the street. Then they started coming up with dirt instead of metal, and they moved on, and this is what got left behind.
Fowler was looking around at the dismal view, and Reacher was following his gaze. Then he transferred his eyes upward a couple of degrees and took in the giant mountains rearing on the horizon. They were massive and indifferent, still streaked with snow on the 3rd of July. Mist hung in the passes and floated through the dense conifers. Fowler moved, and Reacher followed him up a track launching steeply northwest behind the ruined county office. The guards followed in single file behind. He realized this was the track he'd stumbled along twice in the dark the night before. After 100 yards, they were in the trees. The track wound uphill through the forest. Progress was easier in the filtered green daylight. After a mile of walking, they had made maybe a half mile of straight-line progress, and they came out in the clearing the white truck had driven into the previous night. There was a small sentry squad, armed and immaculate, standing at attention in the center of the space, but there was no sign of the white truck. It had been driven away.
"We call this the Bastion," Fowler said. "These were the very first acres we bought."
In the clear daylight, the place looked different. The Bastion was a big, tidy clearing in the brush, nestled in a mountain bowl 300 feet above the town itself. There was no man-made perimeter. The perimeter had been supplied 1 million years ago by the great glaciers grinding down from the pole. The north and west sides were mountainous, rearing straight up to the high peaks. Reacher saw snow again, packed by the wind into the high, north-facing gullies. If it was there in July, it had to be there 12 months of the year. To the southeast, the town was just visible below them through the gaps in the trees where the track had been carved out. Reacher could see the ruined county building and the white courthouse set below it like models. Directly south, the mountain slopes fell away into the thick forest. Where there were no trees, there were savage ravines. Reacher gazed at them, quietly. Fowler pointed.
100 feet deep, some of those, he said. Full of elk and bighorn sheep. And we got black bears roaming. A few of the folk have seen mountain lions on the prowl. You can hear them in the night when it gets real quiet.
Reacher nodded and listened to the stunning silence, tried to figure out how much quieter the nights could be. Fowler turned and pointed here and there.
This is what we built, he said. So far.
Reacher nodded again. The clearing held 10 buildings. They were all large, utilitarian wooden structures built from plywood sheet and cedar, resting on solid concrete piles. There was an electricity supply into each building from a loop of heavy cable running between them.
Power comes up from the town, Fowler said. A mile of cable. Running water, too, piped down from a pure mountain lake through plastic tubing. Installed by militia labor.
Reacher saw the hut he'd been locked into most of the night. It was smaller than the others.
Administration hut, Fowler said.
One of the huts had a whip antenna on the roof, maybe 60 feet high, shortwave radio, and Reacher could see a thinner cable strapped to the heavy power line. It snaked into the same hut and didn't come out again.
You guys are on the phone? He asked.
Unlisted, right? He pointed, and Fowler followed his gaze.
The phone line, he said, runs up from York with a power cable.
But there's no telephone. World government would tap our calls. He gestured for Reacher to follow him over to the hut with the antenna, where the line terminated.
They pushed in together through the narrow door. Fowler spread his hands in a proud little gesture.
"The communications hut," he said.
The hut was dark and maybe 20 feet by 12. Two men inside, one crouched over a tape recorder listening to something on headphones, the other slowly turning the dial of a radio scanner. Both long sides of the hut had crude wooden desks built into the walls. Reacher glanced up at the gable and saw the telephone wire running in through a hole drilled in the wall. It coiled down and fed a modem. The modem was wired into a pair of glowing desktop computers.
"The National Militia Internet," Fowler said.
A second wire bypassed the desktops and fed a fax machine. It was whirring away to itself and slowly rolling a curl of paper out.
"The Patriotic Fax Network," Fowler said.
Reacher nodded and walked closer. The fax machine sat on the counter next to another computer and a large shortwave radio.
"This is the shadow media," Fowler said. "We depend on all this equipment for the truth about what's going on in America. You can't get the truth any other way."
Reacher took a last look around and shrugged. "I'm hungry," he said. "That's the truth about me. No dinner and no breakfast. You got someplace with coffee?"
Fowler looked at him and grinned. "Sure," he said. "Mess hall serves all day. What do you think we are, a bunch of savages?"
He dismissed the six guards and gestured again for Reacher to follow him. The mess hall was next to the communications hut. It was about four times the size, twice as long and twice as wide. Outside, it had a sturdy chimney on the roof, fabricated from bright galvanized metal. Inside, it was full of rough trestle tables in neat lines, simple benches pushed carefully underneath. It smelled of old food and the dusty smell that large communal spaces always have. There were three women working in there. They were cleaning the tables. They were dressed in olive fatigues, and they all had long, clean hair and plain, unadorned faces, red hands, and no jewelry. They paused when Fowler and Reacher walked in. They stopped working and stood together, watching. Reacher recognized one of them from the courtroom. She gave him a cautious nod of greeting. Fowler stepped forward.
"Our guest missed breakfast," he said.
The cautious woman nodded again.
"Sure,"
she said.
"What can I get you?"
"Anything," Reacher said, "as long as it's got coffee with it."
5 minutes. The woman said.
She led the other two away through a door where the kitchen was bumped out and back. Fowler sat down at a table, and Reacher took the bench opposite.
3 times a day this place gets used for meals, Fowler said. The rest of the time, afternoons and evenings mainly, it gets used as the central meeting place for the community. Beau gets up on the table and tells the folks what needs doing.
Where is Beau right now? Reacher asked.
You'll see him before you go, Fowler said. Count on it.
Reacher nodded slowly and focused through the small window toward the mountains. The new angle gave him a glimpse of a farther range, maybe 50 miles distant, hanging there in the clear air between the earth and the sky. The silence was still awesome. Where is everybody? He asked.
Working, Fowler said. Working and training.
Working, Reacher said. Working at what?
Building up the southern perimeter, Fowler said. The ravines are shallow in a couple of places. Tanks could get through. You know what an abatis is?
Reacher looked blank.
He knew what an abatis was.
Any conscientious West Pointer who could read knew what an abatis was. But he wasn't about to let Fowler know exactly how much he knew about anything, so he just looked blank.
"You fell some trees," Fowler said. "Every 5th or 6th tree, you chop it down. You drop it facing away from the enemy. The trees around here, they're mostly wild pines. The branches face upward, right? So when they're felled, the branches are facing away from the enemy.
Tank runs into the chopped end of the tree, tries to push it along, but the branches snag against the trees you left standing. Pretty soon that tank is trying to push two or three trees over, then four or five. Can't be done. Even a big tank like an Abrams can't do it. 1,500 horsepower gas turbine on it, 63 tons. It's going to stall when it's trying to push all those trees over. Even if they ship the big Russian tanks in against us, it can't be done. That's an abatis, Reacher. Use the power of nature against them. They can't get through those damn trees, that's for sure. Soviets used it against Hitler, Kursk, World War II. An old commie trick. Now we're turning it around against them.
What about infantry? Reacher said. Tanks won't come alone. They'll have infantry right there with them. They'll just skip ahead and dynamite the trees.
Fowler grinned. They'll try, he said. Then they'll stop trying. We've got machine gun positions 50 yards north of the abatises. We'll cut them to pieces.
The cautious woman came back out of the kitchen carrying a tray. She put it down on the table in front of Reacher. Eggs, bacon, fried potatoes, beans, all on an enamel plate. A metal pint mug of steaming coffee. Cheap flatware.
Enjoy, she said.
Thank you, Reacher said.
I don't get coffee,
Fowler said. The cautious woman pointed to the back.
Help yourself, she said.
Fowler tried a man-to-man look at Reacher and got up. Reacher kept on looking blank. Fowler walked back to the kitchen and ducked in the door. The woman watched him go and laid a hand on Reacher's arm.
I need to talk to you, she whispered. Find me after lights out, tonight. I'll meet you outside the kitchen door, okay?
Talk to me now, Reacher whispered back. I could be gone by then.
You've got to help us,
the woman whispered. Then Fowler came back out into the hall, and the woman's eyes clouded with terror. She straightened up and hurried away. There were 6 bolts through each of the long tubes in the bed frame. 2 of them secured the mesh panel which held up the mattress. Then there were 2 at each end, fixing the long tube to the right-angle flanges attached to the legs. She had studied the construction for a long time, and she had spotted an improvement. She could leave 1 flange bolted to 1 end. It would stand out like a rigid, right-angled hook. Better than separating the flange and then jamming it into the open end. More strength. But it still left her with 6 bolts. She would have to take the flange off the leg. An improvement, but not a shortcut. She worked fast. No reason to believe Jackson would fail, but his odds had just worsened. Worsened dramatically. Next to the mess hall were the dormitories. There were 4 large buildings, all of them immaculate and deserted. 2 of them were designated as barracks for single men and single women. The other 2 were subdivided by plywood partitions. Families lived there. The adults in pairs in small cubicles behind the partitions, the children in an open dormitory area. Their beds were 3-quarter-size iron cots, lined up in neat rows. There were half-size footlockers at the ends of the cots. No drawings on the walls, no toys. The only decor was a tourist poster from Washington, D.C. It was an aerial photograph taken from the north on a sunny spring day with the White House in the right foreground, the mall in the middle, and the Capitol end on to the left. It was framed in plastic, and the tourist message had been covered over with paper, and a new title had been hand-lettered in its place. The new title read, "This is your enemy."
"Where are all the kids right now?" Reacher asked.
"In school," Fowler said. "Winter, they use the mess hall. Summer, they're out in the woods."
"What did they learn?" Reacher asked.
Fowler shrugged.
"Stuff they need to know," he said.
"Who decides what they need to know?" Reacher asked.
"Bo," Fowler said. "He decides everything."
"So what has he decided they need to know?" Reacher asked.
"He studied it pretty carefully," Fowler said. "Comes down to the Bible, the Constitution, history, physical training, woodsmanship, hunting, weapons.
Who teaches them all that stuff? Reacher asked.
The women,
Fowler replied. The kids happy here? Reacher asked. Fowler shrugged again.
They're not here to be happy, he said. They're here to survive.
The next hut was empty, apart from another computer terminal, standing alone on a desk in a corner. Reacher could see a big keyboard lock fastened to it.
I guess this is our treasury department, Fowler said. All our funds are in the Caymans. We need some. We use that computer to send it anywhere we want.
How much you got? Reacher asked.
Fowler smiled, like a conspirator. Shitloads, he said. 20 million in bearer bonds. Less what we've spent already, but we got plenty left. Don't you worry about us getting short.
Stolen? Reacher asked.
Fowler shook his head and grinned. Captured, he said. From the enemy. 20 million.
The final two buildings were storehouses. One stood in line with the last dormitory. The other was set some distance away. Fowler led Reacher into the nearer shed. It was crammed with supplies. One wall was lined with huge plastic drums filled with water.
Beans, bullets, and bandages, Fowler said. That's Bo's motto. Sooner or later we're going to face a siege, that's for damn sure. And it's pretty obvious the first thing the government is going to do, right? They're going to fire artillery shells armed with plague germs into the lake that feeds our water system. So we've stockpiled drinking water. 24,000 gallons. That was the first priority. Then we got canned food, enough for 2 years. Not enough if we get a lot of people coming in to join us, but it's a good start.
The storage shed was crammed. One floor-to-ceiling bay was packed with clothing. Familiar olive fatigues, camouflage jackets, boots, all washed and pressed in some army laundry, packed up and sold off by the bale.
You want some? Fowler asked.
Reacher was about to move on, but then he glanced down at what he was wearing. He had been wearing it continuously since Monday morning, 3 days solid. It hadn't been the best gear to start with, and it hadn't improved with age.
Okay, he said.
The biggest sizes were at the bottom of the pile. Fowler heaved and shoved and dragged out a pair of pants, a shirt, a jacket. Reacher ignored the shiny boots. He liked his own shoes better. He stripped and dressed, hopping from foot to foot on the bare wooden floor. He did up the shirt buttons and shrugged into the jacket. The fit felt good enough. He didn't look for a mirror. He knew what he looked like in fatigues. He'd spent enough years wearing them. Next to the door, there were medical supplies ranged on shelves. Trauma kits, plasma, antibiotics, bandages, all efficiently laid out for easy access. Neat piles with plenty of space between. Borkin had clearly rehearsed his people in rushing around and grabbing equipment and administering emergency treatment.
Beans and bandages, Reacher said. What about the bullets?
Fowler nodded toward the distant shed.
That's the armory, he said. I'll show you.
The armory was bigger than the other storage shed. Huge lock on the door. It held more weaponry than Reacher could remember seeing in a long time. Hundreds of rifles and machine guns in neat rows. The stink of fresh gun oil everywhere. Floor-to-ceiling stacks of ammo boxes, familiar wooden crates of grenades, shelves full of handguns. Nothing heavier than an infantryman could carry, but it was still a hell of an impressive sight. The two bolts securing the mesh base were the easiest. They were smaller than the others. The big bolts holding the frame together took all the strain. The mesh base just rested in there. The bolts holding it down were not structural. They could have been left out altogether, and the bed would have worked just the same. She flaked and scraped the paint back to the bare metal, heated the bolt heads with the towel.
Then she pulled the rubber tip off her crutch and bent the end of the aluminum tube into an oval. She used the strength in her fingers to crush the oval tight over the head of the bolt, used the handle to turn the whole of the crutch like a giant socket wrench. It slipped off the bolt. She cursed quietly and used one hand to crush it tighter, turned her hand and the crutch together as a unit. The bolt moved. There was a beaten earth path leading out north from the ring of wooden buildings. Fowler walked Reacher down it. It led to a shooting range. The range was a long, flat alley, painstakingly cleared of trees and brush. It was silent and unoccupied. It was only 20 yards wide, but over a half mile long. There was matting laid at one end for the shooters to lie on, and far in the distance Reacher could see the targets. He set off on a slow stroll toward them. They looked like standard military-issue plywood cutouts of running, crouching soldiers. The design dated right back to World War II. The crude screen printing depicted a German infantryman with a coal scuttle helmet and a savage snarl. But as he got closer, Reacher could see these particular targets had crude painted additions of their own. They had new badges daubed on the chests in yellow paint. Each new badge had three letters. Four targets had FBI. Four had ATF. The targets were staggered backward over distances ranging from 300 yards right back to the full 800. The nearer targets were peppered with bullet holes. "Everybody has to hit the 300-yard targets," Fowler said. "It's a requirement of citizenship here." Reacher shrugged, wasn't impressed. 300 yards was no kind of a big deal. He kept on strolling down the half mile. The 400-yard targets were damaged, the 500-yard boards less so. Reacher counted 18 hits at 600 yards, 7 at 700, and just 2 at the full 800. "How old are these boards?" he asked. Fowler shrugged.
"A month," he said. "Maybe 2. We're working on it."
"You better," Reacher said.
"We don't figure to be shooting at distance," Fowler replied. "Bo's guess is the UN forces will come at night, when they think we're resting up. He figures they might succeed in penetrating our perimeter to some degree, maybe by a half mile or so. I don't think they will, but Bo's a cautious guy, and he's the one with all the responsibility. So our tactics are going to be nighttime outflanking maneuvers. Encircle the UN penetration in the forest and mow it down with crossfire. Up close and personal, right? That training's going pretty well. We can move fast and quiet in the dark. No lights, no sound, no problem at all."
Reacher looked at the forest and thought about the wall of ammunition he'd seen. Thought about Borkin's boast, impregnable. Thought about the problems an army faces fighting committed guerrillas in difficult terrain. Nothing is ever really impregnable, but the casualties in taking this place were going to be spectacular.
"This morning," Fowler said, "I hope you weren't upset."
Reacher just looked at him.
"About Loader, I mean," Fowler said.
Reacher shrugged, thought to himself, "It saved me a job of work."
"We need tough discipline," Fowler said. "All new nations go through a phase like this. Harsh rules, tough discipline. Bo's made a study of it. Right now it's very important. But it can be upsetting, I guess."
"It's you should be upset," Reacher said. "You heard of Joseph Stalin?" Fowler nodded.
"Soviet dictator," he said.
"Right," Reacher said. "He used to do that."
"Do what?"
Fowler said. "Eliminate potential rivals," Reacher said. "On trumped-up charges?" Fowler shook his head.
"The charges were fair," he said. "Loader made mistakes."
Reacher shrugged.
"Not really," he said. "He did a reasonable job."
Fowler looked away.
"You'll be next," Reacher said. "You should watch your back. Sooner or later, you'll find you've made some kind of a mistake."
"We go back a long way," Fowler said. "Bo and me."
"So did Bo and Loader, right?" Reacher said. "Stevie will be okay. He's no threat, too dumb, but you should think about it. You'll be next.
Fowler made no reply, just looked away again. They walked together back down the grassy half mile, took another beaten track north. They stepped off the path to allow a long column of children to file past. They were marching in pairs, boys and girls together, with a woman in fatigues at the head of the line and another at the tail. The children were dressed in cut-down military surplus gear, and they were carrying tall staffs in their right hands. Their faces were blank and acquiescent. The girls had untrimmed straight hair, and the boys had rough haircuts done with bowls and blunt shears. Reacher stood and watched them pass. They stared straight ahead as they walked. None of them risked a sideways glance at him. The new path ran uphill through a thin belt of trees and came out on a flat area 50 yards long and 50 yards wide. It had been leveled by hand. Discarded fieldstone had been painted white and laid at intervals around the edge. It was quiet and deserted.
"Our parade ground," Fowler said sourly.
Reacher nodded and scanned around. To the north and west, the high mountains. To the east, thick virgin forest. South, he could see over the distant town, across belts of trees to the fractured ravines beyond. A cold wind lifted his new jacket and grabbed at his shirt, and he shivered.
The bigger bolts were much harder, much more contact area, metal to metal, much more paint to scrape, much more force required to turn them. The more force she used, the more the crushed end of the crutch was liable to slip off. She took off her shoe and used it to hammer the end into shape. She bent and folded the soft aluminum around the head of the bolt, then she clamped it tight with her fingers, clamped until the slim tendons in her arms stood out like ropes and sweat ran down her face. Then she turned the crutch, holding her breath, waiting to see which would give first, the grip of her fingers or the grip of the bolt.
The wind grabbing at Reacher's shirt also carried some faint sounds to him. He glanced at Fowler and turned to face the western edge of the parade ground. He could hear men moving in the trees, a line of men bursting out of the forest. They crashed out of the trees, six men, line abreast, automatic rifles at the slope. Camouflage fatigues, beards. The same six guards who had stood in front of the judge's bench that morning. Borkin's personal detail. Reacher scanned across the line of faces. The younger guy with the scar was at the left-hand end of the line. Jackson, the FBI plant. They paused and reset their course, rushed across the leveled ground toward Reacher. As they approached, Fowler stood back, leaving Reacher looking like an isolated target. Five of the men fanned out into a loose arc. Five rifles aimed at Reacher's chest. The sixth man stepped up in front of Fowler. No salute, but there was a difference in his stance which was more or less the same thing.
"Bo wants this guy back," the soldier said. "Something real urgent."
Fowler nodded.
"Take him," he said. "He's beginning to piss me off."
The rifle muzzles jerked Reacher into a rough formation, and the six men hustled him south through the thin belt of trees, moving fast. They passed through the shooting range and followed the beaten earth path back to the bastion. They turned west and walked past the armory and on into the forest toward the command hut. Reacher lengthened his stride and sped up, pulled ahead, let his foot hit a root, and went down heavily on the stones. First guy to him was Jackson. Reacher saw the scarred forehead. He grabbed Reacher's arm.
"Mole in Chicago," Reacher breathed.
"On your feet, asshole,"
Jackson shouted back.
"Hide out and run for it tonight," Reacher whispered. "Maximum care, okay?"
Jackson glanced at him and replied with a squeeze of his arm. Then he pulled him up and shoved him ahead down the path into the smaller clearing. Bo Borkin was framed in his command hut doorway. He was dressed in huge, baggy camouflage fatigues, dirty and disheveled, like he had been working hard. He stared at Reacher as he approached.
"I see we gave you new clothes," he said.
Reacher nodded.
"So let me apologize for my own appearance," Borkin said. "Busy day."
Fowler told me, Reacher said. You've been building abatises.
Abatises?
Borkin said.
Right.
Then he went quiet. Reacher saw his big white hands opening and closing.
Your mission is canceled,
Borkin said quietly.
It is? Reacher said.
Why? Borkin eased his bulk down out of the doorway and stepped close. Reacher's gaze was fixed on his blazing eyes, and he never saw the blow coming. Borkin hit him in the stomach, a big, hard fist on the end of 400 pounds of body weight. Reacher went down like a tree, and Borkin smashed a foot into his back.